In the past, a leader was a boss. Today's leader must be partners with their people. They no longer can lead solely based on positional power. Ken Blanchard. The journey of a leader is one that requires us to be open to uncertainty. When looking at the head and heart, two components needed from a genuine leader. The heart tends to want to be protected, and that kind of safety is the biggest limitation we can place on our leaders. Join us today as we delve into the three voices of change on Breakthrough Radio.
Welcome to Breakthrough Radio, a global business radio show where smarter strategies deliver breakthrough results by adding an entrepreneurial touch driving today's profits. Now, get ready for three powerful breakthrough segments with Michelle Price.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on where you're listening to us from. Welcome to Breakthrough Radio. This is Michelle Price here, where we're coming to you from the rainy third coast of Houston, Texas today. And on Breakthrough Radio, we are celebrating 8 years of talking about how to master the inner and outer game of business. Our featured spot today is with David Berry, the author of A More Daring Life, Finding Voice at the Crossroads of Change. Our featured interview is a 60-minute conversation that's a nice deep dive into the topic of the day to allow you to gain a much better understanding, level of knowledge, and application for your business. Thank you for coming to listen to Breakthrough Radio. And if it's your first visit, please make sure you thank the person who told you about us. Here's the scoop. You're going to want to listen without distraction. And that's why you only need to write down one URL today. It's www.thebreakthroughradio.com. Again, that's www.thebreakthroughradio.com. Make sure you do visit and connect with each one of us. And do more than follow. Reach out. Truly connect. Ask us a question. Engage us in conversation. And of course, when it makes sense for your business, hire us. In our last episode, we learned how effective it is to lead with language and what it can mean for both big and small businesses. A big company that's been a great example of finding unique ways to lead with language and engage their customers forward. How will you follow Ford's lead and be more strategic in how you connect and serve your customers? Today's customer, they've changed the game of buying for businesses, no matter what industry you sit in. It's why having a buyer journey map has become mandatory if you want to succeed and grow. This is exactly what we do with our clients when they come to us in growing their business and revenues. We're masters at crafting that roadmap and then showing clients how to structure their execution with precision. Defining what is important to customers today and using the analytics to see how they're making their buying decisions is the savvy way to prepare for their future needs and stay relevant. When you know what is valuable to your customer, you can use that to capture their attention and have it be welcomed. Whether it's 10 or 10,000 customers, your customer journey map will save you time, money, and headaches. That is your sweet spot in business. One that can help you generate profits and gain traction over your competitors. So let's connect and discover how we can help you do that this year. Now for our featured interview today on Breakthrough Radio, brought to you by Ford Motor Company, we're bringing you David Berry. This is actually a wonderful introduction by our regular resident expert on the future of workforce, Yared Akalou. And you know, David is the founder of Rule 13 Learning, an organization dedicated to inspiring meaningful change in organizational life. I'm going to tell you, this is going to be a very different book if you have not read A More Daring Life. So please join me as we welcome David Berry to Breakthrough Radio. How are you doing today, David?
Good morning, Michelle. I'm doing terrific. How are you?
Well, to hold my hand up and all truthfulness, we want a break from the rain, dude.
Well, you're happy to have you join us in Southern California anytime.
I know. I've got so many friends in California going, can we just build a pipeline? I'm like, I wish we could. I've had some friends just finish getting everything all back together out of the Memorial Day flood last year, and they got flooded again this year. So you know some people aren't real happy here.
No, I'm sure they're not.
Well, you know, one of the things that stood out for me when I was reading A More Daring Life was something directed at readers that reminded me of a skill I learned years ago to uncover the gap in execution by asking, is this a knowledge or a willingness issue? You know, you shared that within each of us, we have everything we need to thrive in the face of complexity and change, and to decide whether we're willing to do the work or willing to lead a more daring life. Does it really boil down to willingness?
Oh, I am deeply optimistic about the human capacity for adaptation to change. I'm fundamentally committed to that as a truth, which makes a lot of sense given the work that I do. But I've spent so much time around leaders, really capable, smart leaders, and I've just observed myself in my own experience. And I think when we're able to confront the part of ourselves that is really resistant to a shift from the status quo, when we're able to be honest about the forces that are at work in us and in our organizations and the things happening around us, I do believe that choice is the first and most important act we can make. I absolutely agree that what that can reveal are skill gaps that need to be addressed. But what I notice so much of is the denial of the need to change, which in effect becomes the denial of the need to learn or take on new learning because of the vulnerability that creates.
You know, I remember, it's probably been 5 years now, maybe even longer. I remember those of us who were early adopters of Twitter, we used to have Twitter chats, and the one that I led, you know, I just kind of tabled, and the one that some colleagues of mine led around leadership, they've tabled, because, you know, after a while, it takes a lot of endurance to do something on a weekly basis. Gosh, don't I know it, after 8 years creating this radio show. But yep. One of the things that I noticed that there seemed to be the most argument about in that leadership Twitter chat was around whether or not leaders needed to be vulnerable. Boy, when I introduced that, it was like taking the can off a stink.
It's a deeply contentious and a really, really dynamic conversation, which means it's an incredibly important one. Anything that's that contentious deserves a little more attention. And I think we're still telling ourselves some old stories about the kind of leadership that works in an age of massive transparency, in an age of massive complexity, and really in an age of a speed of work that is unmatched. The temptation, of course, is to control. The temptation is to sit in the midst of all of this uncertainty and all of this unknown and give way to the initial impulse, which is to hold on just as tightly as we possibly can. The leader I want to follow is the leader who says, I have a lot to offer to the complexity of this moment, and I do not know how to do it all. I am not certain about certain elements of the changes that we are facing. I am not certain about how to go as fast as our customers, our society, and the world is demanding that we go. So, since I don't know how to do all of that, perhaps we, as a group, could come together and in our collective wisdom figure out the way forward. Now, I think some people would just describe that as common sense leadership and may not apply the term vulnerability, but any time a leader says, I don't know, it raises the specter of being weak. And I actually think what it does is brings a strength to our leadership that is observed by our followers as evidence of our common humanity. I believe people want to see that their leaders exist in the same world they do, and because they normalize the common truth that we're all trying to figure it out, I believe they're much more willing to follow a wholehearted leader willing to say, I don't know and I need some help.
Ooh, I like that, a wholehearted leader. You know, it's interesting, David, because for a really long time, I've talked about how you show up as an entrepreneur, who you are as a person, how you show up as an entrepreneur has everything to do with how well your business is going to do. And a lot of times that has gone over people's heads until they start talking about their problems and their challenges. And I start asking them questions of, well, so where does that show up in your personal life? You know, just challenging them to look at, this could potentially be a core thing that I, as a person, need to address within me in order for me to be able to grow from it. Therefore, when I show up in my business, I'm bringing all of me. Why
yes.
is that so hard for people to comprehend?
I think, and I speak from my own experience wrestling with this dynamic, it is far easier to, you know, working from the very capable and rational minds that we have, it's far easier to separate into these false categorizations. You know, my left coast term for it is a holistic approach, and it means exactly what you just said. I bring all of me into the workplace every day, and all of me goes home every day, and what's going on at home follows me to work, what's going on at work follows me home, not to mention any unresolved dynamics within myself are going to play out in any scenario in which I am an active participant. And my call for a more daring life is the daring to look at those truths, to simply say, I know there's parts of me at work that are not as effective as they could be, that I need to address, and there are parts of me that are the root and the center of my effectiveness and my strength, and those need attention as well. How do I get a clear ability to give voice to those, to articulate those first in myself and then to others? So again, we're operating at a level that says, these things exist, let's name them, and by naming them, normalize them, and by normalizing them, be able to work with them in a way we hadn't previously been able to do.
Can you remember 30 years ago, or even 20 years ago, when people were told to leave your personal stuff at home, it's not professional, it has no place in the workplace, yet it still affects you, and so many people felt almost like schizophrenics. They had to try to pretend to be one person at work and pretend to be one person at home, and nary the two were supposed to meet.
I can absolutely remember it, and what it evokes in me is a feeling of exhaustion. You know, it's hard enough to live one life, and to have to go through all of the struggle and challenge to separate these identities and separate this existence is very, very difficult. And I just don't think. And one of the posts that you shared leading up to this talk today was about, you use the word arduous, that leading a more daring life doesn't have to be so arduous. And I think if we can integrate, gather together these separate pieces of ourselves, it's a far less arduous thing to do than to continue to hold up this old and false construct that I have these multiple identities. I may have multiple roles, and those roles are essential to understand and deliver as a husband, as a father, as a professional, as a community member, and so on. But that can be fully integrated, and I trust that while I'm playing those separate roles, if I'm operating at my best, I'm still showing up as a whole person. I'm still bringing a consistency to my approach, whatever the different roles may be asking of me.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that for people, because I think too many times what happens is they hear something at work, and because, let's face it, we're all typically in a situation where we can't afford to just completely disagree and argue with what happens at work so that we're not labeled as problems. If people aren't willing to be open-minded enough to talk about this in a really honest fashion, they're the cause of a lot of the challenges. And, you know, I've seen changes shift over time, but I'm also still see people, I'm trying to think of how to articulate this, but it's almost as if it's easier just to use something that's been stated over and over and accept it as a truth than it is to examine it and take out what doesn't work and restructure the sentence or the statement or the proclamation in order for it to be accurate.
Yeah, I absolutely. And this is part of what I think about as the seduction of the status quo, that it's so much easier to stick with what is known because of the unrest or the uncertainty that can be triggered as we start to wade through the murky waters of new ways of being. The organizational, you know, world, these places, some large, some small, I think are at a really fascinating transition point. The amount of money, for example, being dumped into engagement studies and surveys, and yet the lack of any real shift in the number of people who voluntarily say they're engaged at work hasn't shifted anything. And so what that tells me is that there's the belief that we must do something, but when it comes back that what we really have to do is re-examine what we mean by culture, re-examine what we mean by leadership, re-examine, therefore, our hiring practices, re-examine our value system, whoa, that is so overwhelming to what's known in the enterprise that I think it becomes paralyzing, and it's left to a few enterprising leaders to decide for themselves that it's time to operate in a different way because the rules have changed and the expectations have changed, and we know that great performance comes when people feel like they've got ownership, they've got trust, they've got the commitment of their bosses to bring out the best in them and give them the greatest opportunities they can to do their best work. That's where businesses thrive. That's how they thrive. And yet the culture of leadership and the culture of organizational life isn't fully yet aligned behind that understanding in a way that will promote real change. I know it's coming. I'm optimistic that it is. It's just a slow and definitely difficult process to get there.
The thing that I find interesting, David, is that in the entrepreneurial world, we don't have the same constraints as our siblings in business of the enterprise or even some of the medium-sized companies. It's almost as if their size works against them, and we've definitely seen that happen with some big boys go out of business because of all the changes that are coming about, and they just aren't able to be agile enough to be able to take the right kind of actions in the time frame in order for the customer to go, okay, I'll trust you again.
Right.
So I know you created three different segments inside your book. What made you divide them up into those three, and would you share what those three are with listeners since they don't have a copy in front of them yet?
No, I'd be happy to. The organization of the book came from two places. The observation of leaders I had the privilege of working with in a very dynamic and competitive consumer products organization where I had the opportunity to lead a team of coaches in support of leadership development. And as I watched these leaders operate in the context of a very fast-growing, fast-changing organization, I started to notice what capacities led to some thriving in that environment, operating in that environment more successfully than others. And then I did the work of just looking at my own leadership experience and where was I, what stories was I telling myself? Where was I tripping over myself? And what I realized is that our effectiveness to ground ourselves, create a strong enough foundation that we can tolerate the vast amounts of complexity and change comes from the ability to articulate three really clear and strong voices. And I call these voices because leadership, and I'm not talking about extroversion or introversion here, I'm certainly not talking about charisma, but at some point, a leader has to lead. A leader has to stand out. A leader has to clarify their intention about the way forward and what's necessary and how he or she sees that unfolding, and then get people to buy into that vision and go forward. So the first voice, as I started to look at myself, is this voice of understanding, the voice of understanding what makes me up. As we've already touched on in the conversation, what's going on inside of me, and how clearly do I even understand that? And I'm talking, you know, I recognize that as I talk about this, it can sound abstract, and I want it to be as practical as possible. And I say, so if we have a clear voice of understanding, that means we would be able to articulate a value system, what we stand for and why we stand for it, how we make decisions. We would be able to articulate our strengths, what we know we do well, and what we most want to offer that leads to our best engagement, which then helps us as a leader figure out, you know, where to fill in the gaps and get other people on the team contributing. We would be able to articulate our limitations in an honest way, and so we could actually do some work on those. And so this voice of understanding is simply another way of saying that great leadership starts within. I cannot expect anyone else to change unless I'm willing to change myself. And so for each of us, that's an individual process and journey, but it's an essential one if we're going to bring a quality of integrity to our work and get to that place of common humanity that I think is so essential to helping other people perform well, which is a great segue into the second voice, which is this voice of connection. So if I'm clear about who I am, then I can be a facilitator of others being clear about who they are. And it's in that exchange, as a leader, being a catalyst for others, relying on others, asking for help, evaluating the quality and strength of my relationships, is how I can articulate a really clear and powerful voice of connection. It's the recognition that even though I've got to do all of this independent work to fully understand who I am, no good happens in the world if it's not done by people gathered together for the sake of achieving something great. And so a leader connects themselves to others in a really thoughtful and purposeful way. And from that connection, we now open up the possibility of a clear voice of exploration. So I know who I am. We know who we are. Now, what do we need to go explore and learn in order to be able to confront the new questions that we face? Because the playbook we've been using in many, many cases is the playbook that relates directly to our being able to perpetuate the status quo. And if the status quo is no longer good enough to build our business, to grow the enterprise, to satisfy our customers, we probably need to be seeking out new questions and new answers to those questions. And the only way we can do that is by venturing out. And I simply believe that having the foundation of understanding, having the foundation of connection, then equips us to go explore and learn in an economy that today, I believe, is as much about learning as it is about anything else.
Of those three voices, David, I'd be curious to ask you, which one do you think people have the hardest time working with or learning or even relearning came up as I was listening to you share the definition of all three?
Well, I always go back to the voice of understanding. I was, and I'll give you an example from my own experience. And this is a story that really helped me cement my sense of purpose in putting this book together. I attended a conference a couple of years ago up on Whidbey Island, which is just north of Seattle, and the Whidbey Institute sits on this gorgeous piece of forested property. And we were going to have very long working days at this leadership conference, and so I said, I'm going to get up early every day, and I'm going to go out into that forest and hike those trails so I can get a good workout in, get myself prepared and engaged for really meaningful work during the day. And for me, the way I do that is I get out and get some good exercise. Well, I got up, and it was, 6:15 in the morning, and it was just pitch black outside and raining. And instead of thinking about the scenario from the place of understanding or learning or connection, I just went crashing through the forest at full speed and had the arrogance later on to get frustrated that I got lost. And here's the really frustrating part about it. On the next morning, I did exactly the same thing, and I got lost again. And on the third morning, to my embarrassment and to my frustration, I did it again. Because I was unwilling in that moment to recognize that I was the foreigner here. I was the intruder. The place was fully understandable. There were very legible trail markers. It was not a difficult terrain to navigate for someone willing to stop themselves long enough to pay attention, to slow down a little bit, to recognize that I have something to learn in this moment. And there I was, barreling through, stuck in my gear for engaging the world, not attending to the part of me that had to shift to accommodate, literally in this case, the new territory that I was in. And it took me three mornings, and I'm afraid if there was a fourth morning, I'd have done it again. But I got saved because I had to fly home that day. And so on that return trip, I thought, what was going on? And it was my unwillingness to just notice myself. It was my unwillingness to say, David, you get so set on something, you go full bore and look at what happens when you're not willing to notice your need to go at your speed rather than your need to see what's going on around you, take in, take a breath, slow yourself enough so that you can be successful in what you set out to do. And so I really believe that the universal is in the particular. And so I'm thinking about my particular experience of blindly crashing through the woods, and I thought, this is what's going on all around us. This is what people are doing every day in the face of the unknown, in the face of uncertainty. And until we stop and have that first conversation with ourselves that says, hey, this isn't working anymore. This approach is not gonna lead to a successful outcome to this challenge. That starting within has to be the first thing we take on.
When you stop and you think about asking yourself those questions to help you understand more about who you are or even the pace in which you take things, do you really think that you had time in those 3 days for you to come to that conclusion, or was the beauty in that lesson that as you left, it kind of hung across your shoulders like a heavy, I'm literally thinking of like the days when they used to have to wear the big metal, what is that called? When they used to have to wear the big metal things and they would fight with, swords and spear.
The lances. Armor.
Armor.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the weight of that armor, right?
Yeah, so. Lessons aren't always in the present. Sometimes it's later on when we're feeling that weight that all of a sudden we have the insight or we can see it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I had the gift of running into that particular wall 3 days in a row in a very concrete way. And I think when you string it together like that, some new awareness is possible. I hold myself to a very high standard, an unfair one for sure. And I think that that's another element of high achieving, highly determined people. This challenge of perfectionism, this challenge of I should have had this figured out much sooner. That's such a powerful impediment to learning. And so, I think the combination of the repetition and then the space to your really important point is what allowed me to come to the insight. What I hope to cultivate in more and more leaders through coaching and through writing and speaking and whatever venues are available is the willingness to take the lesson from the experience, is the willingness not to fly home and say, geez, you know, silly me, I couldn't figure out those trails, but to go a level deeper that says, what the heck is going on with me? That I was so capable of repeating the same pattern multiple times, and what is that telling me about what I might need to explore? And if I'm really honest, how is that very thing playing itself out in my relationships, in my project leadership, in my organizational leadership? And the likely truth is that it is, and it's a rich and ripe opportunity for further exploration.
You know, David, not everybody's willing to look at their contrast and find the lessons that are trying to present themselves. I'll hold my hand up and go, it's taken me time to really be able to appreciate that and embrace it in a totally different way, because I used to look at it afterwards and go, okay, well, that's not what I wanted to accomplish. Okay, I see I could have done that differently. And I'll do that whole game of what worked well, what didn't work well, what can I do different next time. And that's a level of learning. It's a level of learning that not everyone is willing to even spend that much time on. But what I'm noticing that you're sharing right now is something that goes even deeper than that. And I love how you said a level deeper, because, you know, sometimes people don't want to go a level deeper. They anticipate having to explore something deeper than on the surface as being painful.
Yes.
And I'm almost not sure how to help them realize that if you're going to keep handling things on the surface level, that means you're willing to continue to have something hit you in the shins for the rest of your life versus learning how to remove it from the path, period.
That's right. Hey, I don't want to do it either. Make no mistake, I don't like getting feedback. I don't like the feelings of, you know, I'm supposed to be competent. I'm supposed to be an expert. And the fact that I can marry, that the opportunity is to marry, that can be true. I can be an expert. I can be a competent professional doing good work and somebody who is still learning, who is still a work in progress. But I don't like the feeling any more than anyone else does. But here's what comes from it. And what comes from it is freedom. It's what you said. You can address the things that keep coming at you, and you can be free of them. And when you taste that freedom, that is no longer an impediment, or I should say it's maybe no longer as big an impediment as it once was, because now you've done the work to name it and normalize it, which by doing so diminishes it and makes it something that you can start to work with rather than something that's going to knock you over every time. And be be a source of deep challenge and get in the way of what it is that you want to do. I believe freedom is what's available to anyone who's willing to take a harder look. But until you're on the other side of it, it can be really uncomfortable to get to it.
Mm. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I remember working with a woman called Allison Armstrong out in California. She has a whole series of women and men communication workshops, and then she goes really deeply into some things for women. And you have to take her things in a specific order because you're literally doing the work. I mean, she's one of the few people that I've learned understands that, yes, you give some lecture and you share things, but you're really doing the work in her workshop instead of just listening and just some silly little exercises. And when I walked out of one of those and I finally had a comprehension that my number one core need was freedom, oh my goodness gracious, it answered everything that I ever had a challenge with. It answered why I needed to be an entrepreneur versus an employee. It answered why, as much as we grew up with the whole constraints of, you know, to be a happy woman, one must get married and have children and blah, blah. And I'm like going, okay, so now I understand all the pain I went through in that part of the journey of my life. And it was such... It gave me such an opportunity to ask myself a different set of questions when not just facing a problem, but when making choices in my life, whether it's personal or professional. It made it so much easier to make those choices. I see so many people struggling with decisions, and now all I have to do is go, okay, does this give me more freedom or does it take freedom away? If it takes freedom away, it's a definite no on my part. There is no thinking.
Yes, yeah, and good for you. I mean, really, that's so great. And how great is the work that the construct of the work you were able to do to help you get to that place. One of the biggest concerns that I have in the just ocean of tools, resources, programs available is that we're always so hungry for the silver bullet, right? The easy fix, the solution that will, you know, this thing is finally the answer. And this plays out in all aspects of life. The truth is you have to do the work. You just have to do the work if you want an outcome similar to the one you described, which is you are leading a more integrated, coherent life experience because you did the work to get clear on what was core to you. Now, everyone, I'm sure, who interacts with you, and certainly the people who knew you then and knew you now, and still know you now, must notice how much more at ease, how much more clear you are. I'm guessing just that ripples out to the people that you interact with every day, and it gives them something extraordinary, which is a way to interact with you that serves them as well, because your clarity and your sense of purpose, I think, extends it, that when we have that, it extends well beyond us, and other people start to say, that's helping me, that they are clearer, and it's also making me hungry to get clear for myself. And I think that's the heart of the conversation, and that's certainly the heart of this voice of connection, is the way that when we do this work, we can connect it to other people.
I'd be curious to ask you, of the stories that you shared, either in understanding or in connecting with others, which one would you state was probably the one that gave you the hardest time, and did it also deliver you the most reward?
Yes, there's a story, an experience we had as a family a few years ago where we were on vacation in the beautiful part of Northern California, true Northern California, up near the Oregon border, and we decided to take our girls fishing for the first time, and so we went to this beautiful little mountain lake my wife had frequented on excursions as a child, and I'm not much of an outdoorsman. I'm not afraid to say it. And my father-in-law most definitely is. And so we asked Bob if he would give us some fishing gear to help us go fishing on this day. And he didn't have any, but he went out and picked some up, a couple really basic rods and reels from Walmart. And he handed them to me with a look that said, you know, David, I think even you should be able to figure these out. And we went to the lake. And, you know, I'm so competitive, and I so want this to be a great experience, and I take all this time assembling these rods and reels, and I hand one to one of my daughters, and my wife helps her cast it, and as I turn to hand the other rod to my other daughter, I hear over my shoulder, hey, I've caught a fish, and sure enough, the first daughter is pulling a fish out of the lake, and then as I had turned my attention to her, my second daughter had put her line in the water, and she said the same thing. In 5 minutes, they had both caught these beautiful little rainbow trout. And I just thought, wow, like, fishing's the easiest thing in the world. Like, no big deal. And so we were so proud and had a great day. Well, the next summer, of course, we had to go do it again because there we are on a return visit, and we know how to fish, you know. I know how to fish, so let's go fishing again. And we get to the lake, and I set things up exactly the same. We're standing in precisely the same spot. And we get the lines in the water, and nothing happens. And this isn't that frustrating, except for the fact that the two people next to us and the guy down the lake a few yards and the people across are all catching fish, and they're catching a lot of fish. And I'm starting to get frustrated, and I just don't understand, you know, because you know, based on precisely one experience of success with fishing, of course, it should always work the same way, at least in my calculation of it. And finally, the person sitting near us sort of, she must have grown tired of our futility or just took some pity. She sort of nudges the can of fishing bait down the rail and says, you know, they're sure liking this stuff today, and I begrudgingly try it, and of course it doesn't work. And I notice a man get up as if he's packed up for the day, and I think, oh, he's just going to his car. Well, he was actually coming straight towards us, and I could tell he was going to come and offer help, and I was noticing how much defensiveness I was feeling about this and how much I was dreading being proven somebody who really didn't know what he was doing. And sure enough, this guy comes over and he says, I sure would like to see your kids catch some fish. And I said, you and me both, buddy. And I started to stammer. I said, but last year we were here in the same spot. We did the same thing and it worked just fine. And he says, when were you here? I said, it was the first week of June. He says, well, it's late July. And the comment was totally lost on me, and I stared at him, and he could just see that I wasn't catching what was going on. He said, you know, these are cold water fish, and so as summer temperatures increase, there's no cold water on the surface, and so the fish have to go to the bottom of the lake to find that cold water, and you've got a bobber on your line that's keeping your hook about a foot underneath the surface of the water. And it was like he gave me brand new eyes, and I saw for the first time not another person around that lake had a bobber on their line. And he said, I'd be happy to reset your line, and he did, out of his own stuff, out of his own tackle box. Taught us how to cast out into some deeper water, and within an hour we were catching fish just like everybody else. But see, I wasn't, the reason this really stuck with me is I wasn't willing in the moment where things weren't working the way I knew they should. I wasn't willing to start to ask myself some questions like, hey, David, you know how you hold on too tightly when things are sort of slipping out of control and you're feeling that vulnerability of not knowing what to do? Yeah, you're doing that right now. Or, you know how you're sometimes resistant to connect with other people who are clearly having success because you don't want to feel uncomfortable that you haven't already figured it out? Well, those two people sitting next to you, they knew what they were doing, and if you had just leaned over and said, hey, can you help me out, you probably would have gotten there a whole lot sooner. It took a guy going out of his way, you know, essentially bashing me across the forehead to say, you know, pardon me while I interrupt your futility, but there's another way to do this. And if it hadn't been for him, I would never have known that the only difference in from June to July in my limited perspective was the temperature of the water, a change that my lack of expertise would never have allowed me to take note of. And so it was totally necessary to have an attitude of humility, have an attitude of learning, have an attitude of connection to others in order to have a successful experience. And I walked away from that day thrilled that we got to have another successful experience, but really ashamed that I hadn't been able to apply my own learning in this moment. And I'll make one last comment about this story, because I think another level of learning is that in organizational life, large or small, day one, when we caught the two fish within 5 minutes, would be considered more successful because it meets the metrics that we're so used to using of speed and efficiency and results, immediate gratification. But day two allowed us to learn lessons, allowed me to get new information that I will never forget. I didn't walk away from day one any smarter than I was when I started. I just had a couple of fish to show for it. But is it possible for me to ever go fishing again in my life without that second day just imprinted on my memory, which will make me more willing to learn, more willing to check my environment, more willing to create an experience that is actually sustainable rather than one that was a flash in the pan and seduced me into thinking I knew what I was doing and didn't have anything else to learn?
You know, I'm sitting here as I'm listening to you, also seeing this be a great example of what can happen to entrepreneurs. Some can go out and be really successful that first time. Then when they have to go out that second time and they use the same strategy, use the same thinking, the same mindset that helped them succeed the first time and they don't the second time, they question almost everything except their thinking first. They'll question, well, am I using the right business model? Which is a good question. They'll question, well, maybe our product just sucks and nobody wants it. Well, that's still a good question.
Right.
But so many times I don't notice people understanding how important it is to go, how am I different?
A beautiful book, a book that I've read many times and relied upon for a long time, is called The Art of Possibility by Rosamond and Ben Zander. And Ben Zander is the conductor, last I knew, was the conductor, I believe it's the Boston Philharmonic. And he said something, and if you can ever hear him speak or read his work, I think you absolutely should, because he's just so powerful and so inspiring. But he talked about the day when he realized that the conductor of an orchestra is the only musician who doesn't make a sound. and that his job was to be a catalyst for others being able to be at their very best, that he asks himself this question when he's not seeing the performance or the discipline or the intensity that he believes is so important. He asks this question, says, who am I being? Who am I being that I'm not seeing from my players the kind of performance that I know they're capable of? And you can ask this question as a parent. You can ask this question as an entrepreneur. You can ask this question of any situation over which you have strong influence where you're willing to take responsibility as a person of influence for what is going on. And instead of going down that rabbit hole of all the other possibilities, most common of which is, you know, how or why did they screw this up? And maybe they did, but is it possible that in your leadership of it, there was something that could have happened differently? Is it possible that with that moment of self-reflection that says, I'm responsible for setting the tone and the vision for how this is going to go, and if I haven't kept to that promise as faithfully as I would have liked to, is it really a surprise that I would see these results start to emerge?
Great questions. I'm sitting over here thinking of a situation where I'm going to be meeting with a team, and it's going to be necessary for me to lead off going, okay, so I see the role I played in the mistakes that we had last week, and then I'm going to pass the pencil and ask each person to see if they had any role in the mistakes that were made last week. And I think it's going to be an interesting exercise because it's going to be the first time we've done something like this with that team.
Well, I applaud you for that intention. And I'm actually, you know, I'm really curious to hear what shifts in the room when you go about that, because it is an altogether different experience for the leader to sit and say, I've thought about what happened with this initiative project, whatever it is that we worked on. And in doing so, I noticed a few things about how I engaged in it that could have been different. And I'm wondering if you have any feedback for me about that. Now, the trick with that is that if people are conditioned to not giving feedback, the first time you ask, you probably shouldn't expect that they're going to give you feedback, because that's going to be a high-risk situation for them. But I believe that if we persist with an authentic desire to know, eventually people will be able to say, this is a safe enough environment to have the real conversation that will allow us to break through to a new level of performance. Until it's safe enough to have the real conversation, the truth of the matter is it's not going to happen. Folks are too smart. There's too much need for self-preservation to let their guard down quite that easily. And I've worked for leaders, and I've seen leaders in action who really demonstrate this quality, and after a little while, you realize they really mean it, and the conversations and the possibilities that emerge from those interactions are so much more significant than the old model of sort of platitudes about our performance, which really just leads us to doing the same old thing again.
I totally hear you on that. I can see one group and organization where people take a self trying to think of how to say that word in the right context, but they do take a self-preservation position, yet they also feel comfortable enough pointing out where other people make mistakes. And I'm sitting there inside giggling going, yeah, that's kind of not real productive. Where The two teams that I'm thinking of and the one that I'm going to have the meeting with, they're used to having a more honest conversation. And I see that it's really allowed us to be able to shift and make changes more effectively. We're more fulfilled when we do it, and we're more willing to say out loud, well, we tried it, so we talked about it, and we were all honest about the problem, and then we tried this piece worked, but that piece didn't. And so it's almost as if they're more willing to explore, which I guess that's the third voice then, isn't it?
I think it is.
I just played right into your three voices.
Well done. A totally unscripted moment, but a true one at that. I think it does do that precisely, Michelle. And I think if we work hard to get people out of that defensive posture by asking questions a little bit differently, you know, what would you like to have seen happen differently on this project? What could you have done to help influence that? How would you like to see us proceed differently in the future? See, I think these aren't accusatory. These aren't overly direct or intimidating, but they're still hard questions, and they're still, and I think they're better questions because they open our minds and they really get us into a more curious place. Absolutely, we have to have clear and direct feedback when appropriate. We have to let people know how they're doing. That's a central part of that's a more daring act. That takes courage. That's fulfilling our leadership responsibility. But there's nothing that says we have to or are supposed to do that in a way that erodes trust, that shuts people down, that shuts off their sense of their capability to contribute. In fact, if it's done well, and this is all the way back to where we started, you talk about skill development. So if it's done well, if I develop the skills to give great feedback, to have those tough conversations, people thank us for doing so. People recognize the opportunity they have to learn and grow, and that you're a facilitator of that because you were willing to speak the truth of your experience to them. That's what leads people to engage more further. Not because it's punitive or difficult, but because it's honest and real, and it includes as much heart, as much love, as much care and concern for them as a human being, as it also contains the very rational, very planful parts of us that need to measure performance. When we marry those two things together, I think this is where we're breaking through to much more daring leadership, much more a capacity for influencing people that it doesn't just happen unless we're willing to put the effort into it.
You know, David, I noticed that's a lot easier in smaller groups than in larger groups. How do you dance differently from a smaller group into a larger group?
Well, I actually think it's much easier one-on-one than any place else, you know? And so, you know, if I go back to stopping, the need for me to stop in that forest to find my way and my unwillingness to stop, you know, my recommendation, my hope for leaders is that they'll find their own disciplines of stopping. And one form of stopping, or that feels like stopping, is to prioritize those one-on-one conversations, to slow everything down for just a few minutes to say, hey, how are we doing? What's going on? Here's what I'm seeing. I want to know what you're seeing, because we need to hit the pause button, just like in a fast-paced, really energized basketball game. When that momentum shifts and it's the other team, you know, that was in control starts to lose control, the coach calls a timeout. The coach says, hold on, we're not going to let this thing run away from us. We're going to get our bearings again. We're going to draw up a new play, and doing so doesn't take forever. Doing so only means that we hit the pause button long enough to get our bearings, have the truthful conversations we need, so that when we go back to full speed, we're better equipped than we were a few minutes earlier. And so start at the individual level, then see what happens at the small group level, and then see what happens in the larger group. But I think until we have those more intimate and certainly more challenging conversations, again, first with ourselves, then one-on-one, to expect much shift at a group level is to expect an awful lot. And I think you build the foundation for that ahead of time.
You know, and as I was listening to you, another thing that popped into my mind is the two smaller groups, I handpicked the team. The other one, I just participate in. Ooh, very different dynamic.
Very different. Yep, absolutely different.
But it wasn't until I was listening to you that all of a sudden that surfaced to the, you know, that bubbled up, and I was like, oh, there's a big difference there. You didn't pick that team.
That's right. And that's such an important insight, because that goes back to the roles that we play. If this is my team, I've assembled, I have a different sense of responsibility and ownership for that, but now I'm in a team player role. My responsibility shifts a little bit there. How do I want to show up in that situation? How do I want to help this along as a different kind of influencer than if I'm the team leader? You know, this lens of awareness, this lens of perspective on how we operate and how we connect with others and how we help facilitate learning is so useful regardless of the role that we're in, and it's as applicable from one to the other, for sure.
Well, there's a question that's become our signature question we ask all of our featured guests who come on the show, and I'll tell you that I've only forgotten in the 8 years two times to ask the question. Both times Lou reminded me that I forgot to ask the question. I've never forgotten it again. So thank you, Lou in New York. And I've discovered that sharing how the question came about also adds some flavor and insight instead of just asking the question directly. So what happened is one Saturday, I was watching Star Trek. Imagine that, a Saturday afternoon watching Star Trek. And Spock was doing his mind meld thing where he puts his hands on people's heads and he morphs into their mind and he gets to the beginning to the end of their life. And I was being a little snarky that day, I'll admit out loud. And I said, I don't really care about all that, but you need to explain to me why they made that really dumb decision and choice that they just made. And I thought, huh, wait a minute. What if, instead of trying to have a whole mind meld with people, we could just have a slice of the mind meld? You know, it could just be a little brain download where we could understand how and why they make their choices and their decisions. And then I thought to myself, wow, who would I want to have that with? You know, kind of like that whole question about who would you want to go to dinner with. I was like,
yeah.
Who would I want to have a brain download with that? Oh, my gosh. Okay, so I names just literally started flowing in my head, and I thought, yeah, but they're from the past. Is there anybody in the present that I'd want to have that with? And I thought of a few names, and then all of a sudden I got really daring. I said, I wonder if there's anyone in the future I'd want to have that brain download with. Now, that one really stumped me the most. But, David, if you could have a brain download where you could understand how someone made their choices and their decisions, whether that was someone was from the past, the present, or the future, who would you want to have one from and why?
The list is long. There are just so many mentors who are mentors via their writing, via their podcasting, via their speaking. I admire people like Krista Tippett, whose show On Being is such a powerful one. I think about somebody like Seth Godin, who I so admire. The poet David White is another person. These are people who are taking the time, have taken the time to develop in themselves a sensibility about the world, given where we are and what is emerging in terms of transparency and vulnerability and its impact on real issues like business growth, like economic growth, big world level issues as well. And they're doing it from a very heartful, very loving, very considered place. And so for me, anybody willing to apply their expertise to the marriage of, as some call it, competence and connection, or heart and head, anyone in that space who's really struggling with those questions is somebody I want and need to learn from, because that continues to be and will continue to be my greatest aspiration.
Well, I've got to tell you, this has been a very fun conversation, and so many times I find myself having to really pay attention to the time, going, oh, I don't want to stop, but we've only got a limited amount of time, and I have to.
I so appreciate, Michelle, the chance to be on your show and your thoughtful questions and the chance just to engage in a great conversation. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for helping our listeners to have a better understanding of how they can find the voice, as you say, at the crossroads of change. And we hope that they do learn to live a more daring life.
Well, I certainly do as well. I wish you and all your listeners all the best in their pursuit of exactly that.
Thank you, David.
You're welcome, Michelle. All the best.
Well, within each of us right now is everything we need to thrive in the face of complexity and change. We just have to decide whether or not we're willing to do the work, whether or not we're willing to lead a more daring life. And you can do exactly that by grabbing yourself a copy of David Barry's A More Daring Life. And I'm going to ask you, what piece of that you just learned now are you going to put into action this week? And our brain download question is fun and important. The intention is to remind you to ask yourself, how am I making my choices and my decisions? This is Michelle Price here with Breakthrough Radio, delivering you the best business minds each Monday live. I'm coming to you from the third coast of Houston, Texas, where we work with you a business down the street or around the world, telling your dynamic story, attracting your ideal customers.